WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It looks like General Wesley Clark picked an opportune moment to enter the race for the Democratic nomination for president. As President Bush's approval ratings continued to slide this week, a poll suggested that if the election were held now, Clark would narrowly defeat the president. This despite an early and embarrassing Clark flip-flop on whether he would have voted for the Iraq War. First, the general said probably, then reversed himself to say absolutely not.
The press, of course, is attracted to political blunders. It's also attracted to political frontrunners. And that combination has resulted in some extremely skeptical coverage of the new candidate, as reflected in Clark's first answer to a question in Thursday's debate.
Well, Brian, if I've learned one thing in my 9 days in politics, you better be careful with hypothetical questions.
In this week's National Journal, Bill Powers compared the general's first week in the race with, quote, one of those Nature Channel shows where the unsuspecting little gazelle wanders out into the savanna and is immediately pounced on by a pack of starved hyenas. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be here.
So for the last 4 or 5 presidential election cycles, the media have done a lot of hand-wringing about the way we cover races, focusing on the horse race instead of the issues, overemphasizing blunders by the candidates, and so on. Is there anything about the entry of Wesley Clark into the race that suggests the media have been chastened one iota?
There's something different about the debut of General Clark. There is a substance to the way the media have jumped on him that is very interesting. There's been this kind of instant rejection of him almost on a character basis that I've never seen before this early in a candidacy. And the first signal that was sent up was a front pager in the Washington Post the day he announced his candidacy, which really, if you read between the lines, suggested that he might not be fit for office. I had never seen a piece so troublingly negative, troubling in terms of this guy's possibly being president, on the day the person announced. And it had these shocking quotes from unnamed retired generals who had known him in the Pentagon saying, basically, don't trust this guy.
But I can't imagine any reporter having heard those quotations from inside sources who wouldn't use them in any profile, either at the beginning of a race or thereafter. Was it therefore that unusual?
In the past, there's generally been this sort of unofficial honeymoon period where you kind of get the positive stuff first and the pictures with the family and blah, 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 their record in governing such and such state or whatever. In this case, I think part of the reason may be that General Clark is a longtime Washington insider. Those quotes were not just stuff that some reporter picked up on the phone and had never heard before. Reporters have been talking to him for years. They know what they think of him, and they know what his colleagues think of him. It seems to me there was some kind of decision made that there was such a mass of this stuff that let's go with it. And it appeared not just in the Post and not just in the news columns of other outlets, but in opinion columns right away. Robert Novak, Richard Cohn, across the spectrum, there have been these striking digs about this man's, basically, his fiber as a person.
Does the fact that the media is simply paying so much attention and establishing him as the front runner through polls and punditry, more important than any of the particulars of what the press might be saying? You know, kind of, I don't care what you say about me as long as you spell my name right.
Yes, I mean, the cover of Newsweek is a huge achievement for someone who has just announced. But I do think that these complaints about him and concerns about his character that are being raised are serious. In the middle of this week, you even had retired General Shelton telling an audience that he wouldn't vote for the man.
Now, your column this week says there's actually a disadvantage to being a front runner because immediately the media want to take you down. I mean, what you're describing is a kind of bloodlust. Are the media really bloodthirsty? Isn't there something a little bit more responsible going on?
I wouldn't put my money on that, Bob. I mean, I think they are bloodthirsty for the man on top because that's the eternal great story of journalism. When you get that high in the polls that early and all of a sudden you're number one, the next big story is how you fell from that high position. That's the trouble with starting out in this way. It's almost as if the media has this unconscious belief that you didn't quite earn it.
Are the early reactions of the mainstream press something that General Clark cannot overcome? Is the theme now defined in perpetuity for the balance of the race for the nomination?
No, I don't think it's fatal at all. I mean, we have numerous examples of candidates who have overcome, really, rejection by the mainstream press. I mean, you can go back to Ronald Reagan when he was running for office. And Dean is the most recent example. I mean, Dean was really a bit of a joke, really, in the media for a long, long time. So you can overcome this kind of media skepticism or outright rejection that Clark is seeing, although he is seeing a species of rejection that is quite intense so early in a candidacy, and I think it's going to be a struggle for him.
Let me ask you one more thing. General Clark, in addition to having become a major public figure during the Kosovo campaign, was a commentator for CNN during the bombing in Baghdad. Do you think his work as a pundit and his familiarity with the TV cameras is going to work to his benefit at all?
What happens is, I think when you operate as a pundit, as Clark did, you can kind of convince yourself that it would be easy to do that on a bigger stage, perhaps even as a presidential candidate, because after all, what do they do but talk into the microphone? The difference is, when you're a presidential candidate, you are held to a completely different standard than the one you're held to as a pundit. That's what's happened to him. I mean, he had that flip-flop on the war resolution. Something like that, if he'd done it on television, wouldn't really have been held against him if he was just a pundit. But when you're a candidate, it's gigantic, and you almost get the sense that he didn't realize that you're not forgiven for these things when you've thrown your hat in the ring.
So if you had any advice for General Clark going forward, what would that be?
Well, I hate to give candidates advice. I'm not in that business. But I would say that, you know, if you think you've seen wartime, wait till you deal with the media.
All right, Bill. Well, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Good to be here.
Bill Powers writes about media for the National Journal.
Clark's recent entrance into the race means that there are now 10 Democrats seeking the nomination. But even without such a big field, the 2004 election will be awash in media coverage this year and next. And with each candidate event, newsrooms all over the country will have to decide what's newsworthy. Most campaign stories are national, so might not necessarily belong in a local newscast. But all that changes when one of the candidates is also local. Tom Weber reports from member station KWMU on how the St. Louis media are covering their homeboy, Dick Gephardt.
On a cool Monday night earlier this summer, more than 100 people gathered at a political rally in a small German restaurant in South St. Louis. This is land Dick Gephardt represents in Congress, but folks here are watching tapes of their pick for 2004, Howard Dean.
I'm tired of being told what to do by fundamentalist preachers and right-wing talk show hosts.
Dean's supporters gather here regularly, but the head of Dean's Missouri campaign, Diane Ortbal, says there hasn't been much local coverage of her guy. She thinks that should change, despite the fact that this is Gephardt country.
You know, I don't think that even the Dean campaign plans on winning Missouri. But yeah, the media hasn't given us the time of day yet.
St. Louis's major newspaper, the Post-Dispatch, is currently running a series that runs each Sunday and includes a profile of a different Democrat running for president. Wesley Clark will be a late addition to the series, but it was the paper's five-part series this summer about Gephardt that prompted letters to the editor from some who really don't like the man. People like Robert Gravelin, who wrote that it looks as if the paper is on Richard Gephardt's campaign committee. Gravelin isn't so much concerned with the other Democrats as he is with other Republicans getting equal coverage.
We're in one newspaper town, you know. There should be some kind of a moderation where give the left and the right equal coverage, but it isn't. It just all leans to one side, and that's what I'm not really happy about.
Here at the heart of the American dream, I announce my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
When Gephardt announced his candidacy in St. Louis in February, both local and national news outlets were there. Those events are the easiest of editorial decisions. When a candidate is in town, cover him or her. Earlier this month in Albuquerque, when 8 of the 9 Democrats in the race at the time gathered for a forum, this Gephardt line was one of the most used by all media the next morning.
This president is a miserable failure.
But the lines between a national campaign and a local story are blurred with a local candidate. Ed Bishop edits the St. Louis Journalism Review at Webster University. He has often criticized the Post-Dispatch, but says on this matter, the extra Gephardt coverage is appropriate.
If he did win the presidency, that would mean a tremendous boost to this region. Ask yourself, why is the Johnson Space Center in the middle of Texas? Because when the Johnson Space Center was built, Lyndon Johnson was president of the United States.
The Post-Dispatch's editor, Ellen Soderber, says the paper has a responsibility to cover Gephardt in depth because it's covered him since he was a city alderman and no other paper knows him better.
We aren't out to further Mr. Gephardt's candidacy. We aren't out to undermine it. We're just out to do our jobs. And sometimes defining precisely what that is in a circumstance like this is not the easiest thing in the world.
In that respect, the Post-Dispatch isn't just writing for its subscribers. Its information is online for voters all over the country to access to help them make a choice. And Soderber adds the recent five-part series on Gephardt was not flattering. It showcased his tendencies to switch positions on issues as the political waters change. Newsrooms in other candidate hometowns face similar dilemmas. The Hartford Courant ran an article last month called "Why So Much Lieberman Coverage?" And Frank Abscher, a St. Louis radio historian who has also written for the Journalism Review, says the extra coverage isn't exactly a blessing.
If you get too much attention too early, there's a risk of a burnout factor. And there's also a risk of, what now can I do to keep the attention level so high? That's something that I think Mr. Gephardt needs to be concerned about, as do all candidates for office.
The Post-Dispatch says it will keep informing the nation of the local guy running for president, but as candidates drop out, the effort will switch to giving each of them equal coverage. It's a decision other newsrooms in St. Louis also face in what could be Gephardt's last campaign ever. He has already said he won't run for his seat in Congress again, but if he becomes the first ever president from St. Louis, local media may face a whole new set of challenges. For On the Media in St. Louis, I'm Tom Weber.
Coming up, how Russia covers its elections, not, and how national security concerns quash local information.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Under new rules, Russian media are not allowed to provide any kind of commentary when covering a political campaign. The problem is that the official definition of campaigning is so broad, it leaves reporters with almost nothing to report.
For example, here's some advice for journalists from an official at the Central Election Commission, which issued the new laws. Quote, suppose there is a candidate who promises free apartments to voters if he or she is elected. Journalists may report that fact, but must refrain from any commentary about the candidate or his track record, even if he has pledged free apartments in a previous election but never delivered, because that is not information, it is your analysis and is not appropriate as information. Two, violations by a media organization in an election campaign, and it can be shut down for the duration of the campaign. Fred Weir writes for the Christian Science Monitor and is based in Moscow. Fred, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So this law was supposed to be aimed at curbing the, quote, black PR, or bought and paid for coverage, that marred previous Russian elections. Isn't that a good thing?
Well, sure, although it's kind of like attacking a fly with a sledgehammer.
You wrote in your article that these new regulations smack of Soviet times, except that today's censors are not the Communist Party hacks planted in editorial offices, but the managers of media outlets themselves. So are you saying that they're self-censoring in order to avoid being shut down?
Well, yeah, I think that's the big difference. In Soviet times, the Communist Party basically ran all the press and had their own people in every office sort of scrutinizing every word that went out to make sure that it conformed to the line. And, of course, in those days, everybody else conspired to get around it or confound it in some way, and often in extremely inventive ways. Now, there's considerable privatization of the media, although most of the main TV stations are still state-run. But the fear of being shut down, of losing your job, is what operates there in place of the party censor.
You mentioned the creative ways that people were getting around the restrictions. I read that in a St. Petersburg paper, they reported on a make-believe election in a make-believe land. Obviously, it was a real election they were writing about, only they had changed all the names.
Yes, I think we'll see a great deal more of that now as this election continues, because journalists are rediscovering those old skills to somehow disguise their coverage so the readers will understand. But the Central Election Commission, being mostly old-fashioned bureaucrats, maybe won't.
That's an old Soviet-era tradition, right? Reading between the lines. What's it in Russian? Mezhdu
strokami.
Yeah, and so you're saying the Russians are primed to get their message even if it comes in code.
We'll see whether the public still has those old skills, too. But I imagine people will revert pretty quickly, although that's an awfully sad commentary 12 years after the Soviet Union collapsed.
These laws stipulate that all of the 44 parties running for parliament must be given equal space and treatment by the media. Some of these parties are pretty marginal.
It does come down to that absurd situation in which parties that have just appeared on the political horizon, you know, parties that have no chance whatsoever of making it into parliament, will have to be covered equally with the Yabloko party, which is Russia's only liberal party and will almost certainly be back in parliament, and of course the communists, who are the biggest opposition force, regularly poll about 25% of the vote. And so I think in the application of the law there, it seems almost designed to drag down Yabloko and the communists.
When communism died, it seemed that free speech was one of the most prized benefits of the emerging democratic system. Are we seeing an incremental erosion of the free press under Putin?
Well, I think it's definitely backwards movement, and it's not just in election coverage. The Kremlin itself uses the term managed democracy for what they're trying to bring about, which basically means the unruly elements, what Russians often think of it as destructive and anarchistic elements of democracy, will be pruned out, leaving only the smooth, stately process, which doesn't contradict where the Kremlin wants to go. I think that's the idea, and it's now several years down the road, and there is very, very little, I think, actual independent media in Russia or outspoken dissent in the society. So in this respect, the Kremlin has got what it has wanted.
Okay. Thanks very much, Fred.
You're welcome.
Fred Weir writes for the Christian Science Monitor and is based in Moscow. This week, Attorney General John Ashcroft continued his multi-city tour, barnstorming for additional government control of information under the Patriot Act. On this program, we've addressed the potential impact of the act on the national level, but does that impact extend to local cops and city officials too? Keith McKnight is a reporter for the Akron Beacon Journal in Akron, Ohio. Recently, he wrote that a host of modifications, large and small, in the past 2 years have lessened the public's grip on what local government is doing. Keith, welcome to On the Media.
Well, thank you.
Okay, so you've been in the business for 4 decades, and you, of all people, know that the relationship between reporters and law enforcement officials is usually not especially cozy. What's changed?
Well, since 9-1-1, as a matter of fact, we have had a number of small incidents around here in which we have now a spokesman for the police department in Akron, and the spokesman every day lists what she thinks are the important stories of the day for reporters to pick up on a recorded information line. I alluded to one in the story I wrote recently, which is a drive-by shooting, and I called to say, you know, what happened? And I got a hold, luckily, of the detective who was in charge of it, and he said, well, if it's anything important, it'll be on the information line. Later on that evening, there was nothing on the information line, so apparently it wasn't important. But the point of it is, they decided we didn't.
So the local police decide what police actions are worthy of coverage, and that wasn't the case 30 years ago?
Oh, no. No, it wasn't the case 5 years ago. And again, it's a small change, but a significant one to anybody who is in this business. We are accustomed to deciding for ourselves what the news is and is not. And we don't like somebody else, particularly a government official of any sort, deciding it for us.
Do these changes relate in any way then to 9/11?
No, I don't think it has a thing to do with national security. I think the 9/11 terror has also opened up a sort of mania among public officials or an opportunity to say no when information would otherwise be available.
What about access to local government or to hospital officials, for example?
Well, HIPAA recently went into effect. That's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It was passed in 1996 by Congress, but it didn't come into effect until this year, in which they essentially have bottled up, in the name of privacy, all the records of anybody who goes to the hospital and doesn't expressly sign a release for it to be released. Recently, there was an example here. The Canton paper called up on a fire call, and they said, where's the fire? Well, that's a very normal thing for a newspaper to ask a fire department. But they said they couldn't release the information, and it was because if there was a fire, there might be an injury, and if there was an injury, you would have to release the information about that individual who was injured, and therefore they couldn't talk about such things.
Do you have any evidence that local governments in other parts of the country are tightening their control over information?
Well, I talked to a professor of Pace University, Brian Nickerson, and he said that he had received several calls from reporters around the country who were concerned about the same issue. These are issues that if you bring them up on a local basis, it's the local media whining about something that doesn't really affect the national picture at all. But when you put them all together, the public is being kept farther away from information that they want and need.
Keith, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Reporter Keith McKnight spoke to us from the Akron Beacon Journal, and now we're joined by the aforementioned Pace University professor, Brian Nickerson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So we heard how this situation is playing out in Akron. Is it happening in other places?
Well, it seems to be a pattern growing in municipal governments, particularly in a post-9/11 era. And what you've seen as a result is, I think, a channeling and additional filtering of information that gets released to the community in various ways, through either a public information office or now through other individuals that try to restrict the flow of information out to the public. A lot of municipal governments have moved towards professionalizing communications officers and information officers, and that's been around for the last 20, 30 years or so, providing information to the general public. For instance, you know, when does the sanitation pick up? What are school days? That type of general information. But now what we're seeing new is a certain line being crossed where now public information officers are being used to be the official spokespersons for elected bodies. And the potential issue here is not only a legal one with respect to perhaps an access or limitation of freedom of speech, but also the issue now of restricting media access to elected officials.
Voters put those people in office, so the idea is that they should be accountable, and they can't do that if they aren't allowed to speak for themselves.
Absolutely. And any time when you have a free speech issue such as this, there's always a balancing question that has to be asked. What's the legitimate interest of government in restricting the access to information or filtering the information versus the right of the public to know what's going on? You can see arguments on both sides.
I'm not sure I see the argument for preventing a reporter from writing something about a drive-by shooting.
Well, I think what you find municipal governments doing, either rightly or wrongly now, is using the notion of public security. So, for instance, a lot of times they will argue that it's a matter of, they don't want to raise mass hysteria and create instability or chaos, which would threaten security. A lot of times you find governments utilizing the notion of protection of confidentiality and right to privacy as another reason to further restrict access to information. And it's also fortified at the federal level by Ashcroft's statement that he's willing to back up any federal bureaucracy or administrative agency who wants to restrict access to information based upon privacy or confidentiality concerns.
To what extent do you think this message was heard and acted on at the local level?
Local officials will always respond to what's going on nationally, particularly in the area of security. And even though Ashcroft can't mandate to a local government what they can and can't do in terms of information, the tone that's set, I think, certainly influences many local government officials, particularly in emergency and police services, towards restricting access to information.
Have you had conversations with specific municipalities over this issue of information, and what have you advised them to do?
I have had conversations, and they feel a lot of times if there are discordant voices coming out of government that does nothing but confuse the public. I advise them to be very cautious. You know, it's basically a good intention, but I think they don't see the whole picture from both a legal standpoint of some of the challenges they may face, as well as just from a standpoint of what local governments are supposed to do in allowing democracy to thrive. People feel connected to local government, and that's been a historical tradition throughout the origins of the United States.
You've said that one reason why people put these spokesmen in place is to keep the message from local government consistent. Mm-hmm. But it's inside the inconsistencies that you can see where perhaps the truth is being shaded. I know this is a tedious preoccupation of journalists, but Ben Bradley once said, never forget, governments lie.
Or they have self-interest. But if you restrict information and your goal is to provide a unified voice from an elected council, the problem with that is that under democracy, they're not supposed to be unified. There's supposed to be discordant voices. There's supposed to be a variety of opinions that come to the table and consensus building. And that needs to be explained and expressed to the public because you have to show that the process is intact and taking place. So the idea of a unified voice, I think this is where the rationale behind the policy really falls short and begins to potentially threaten what we know to be good democracy.
Okay. Brian Nickerson, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. It's my pleasure.
Brian Nickerson is the director of the McCallion Institute for Public Policy and Management at Pace University.
The Advertising Council, which brought you Smokey Bear, McGruff the Crime Dog, and Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk, has spent decades altering Americans' behavior by essentially belaboring the obvious. Since September 11th, the Advertising Council has been unleashing the power of advertising on a more existential problem, America's complacency about its founding principles. Here's a sample of the latest stage of the Freedom Campaign.
If I stay in Cambodia, I would have been dead by now. It was dictated by communists. You have to dress a certain way. You have to look a certain way. If you know how to read and write, you're dead. You speak your mind, you're dead. Why did I come here? Freedom.
Peggy Conlon is the president and CEO of the Advertising Council. Peggy, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
In the spot we just heard, we see a 29-year-old Cambodian immigrant talking about fleeing from a communist repression in Cambodia under the Pol Pot regime to America, where he is now free to live as he wishes. And his testimony is intercut with funky editing, and what you heard is a very sophisticated sound design technique which accompanies these flashing split-second images of American iconography, things like the Statue of Liberty and the Constitution and so forth. What are you going for here?
Bob, there aren't very many of us who don't have relatives that have immigrated. And it kind of taps into our own personal heritage. And we think about how it is that we wound up living in this country.
You took a poll, I understand, and got some insight into Americans' understanding of their basic freedoms. What did you learn?
88% of Americans reported that Americans take freedom for granted. And when you probe them even more deeply, you find that they don't really understand the kind of tenets that we think about when we think about this country's freedoms. When they talk about freedom, they're really expressing freedom of lifestyle, freedom to go where they want, do what they want, say what they want.
This is the second pool of Freedom Campaign spots. Last year, there was one that portrayed an eerie parallel society that looked like ours, but minus our freedoms. And in it, a library patron innocently requested to see some title and was hauled off for questioning by federal agents. But what was most eerie was how close to home the scenario was, because under the Patriot Act, that nightmare is actually taking place in our country right now. I gather that chilling irony was unintended by the Ad Council.
Actually, it was. It was rather ironic that the Patriot Act was passed around the time that we were releasing this body of work. The work had been developed earlier in the year, and that really wasn't on the mind of the creative team.
But there's another lurking irony in this pool of spots as well, because it is a celebration of immigration. All three subjects have come here to our shores to flee repression elsewhere. In the current environment, with the doors slamming on would-be immigrants the world over, does this cut in a way, once again, that's unintended by its authors?
Well, it's certainly unintended, and the Ad Council does not take a position on policy or politics. The fact that we used these patriotic immigrants is really a creative executional device in order to dramatize the importance of freedoms and to compare the kind of lifestyle that we enjoy here today versus countries where people are not allowed to express their political views or some of the other restrictions that you just mentioned.
Let me ask you this. The Ad Council historically has been apolitical. Its function is public service and public awareness. I understand that. But if the Ad Council were to determine institutionally that it was celebrating American freedoms, the ones that we most cherish and should most cherish, while those same freedoms themselves were shrinking by 20%, would you think about just cutting the campaign off?
I think that to have this campaign out there at this time is very, very important, because what we're doing is we are stimulating a dialogue. We need to have a more informed public who can make decisions about the kind of government that they want. And so the ability to educate people about freedom, have them think about what freedom means to them, and therefore have that translate into the democratic process, I think is a very important issue. And no, I don't think that this is a time when we should be tabling a discussion about freedom. It's, I think, more important than ever.
All right. Well, Peggy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Peggy Conlon is the president and CEO of the Ad Council.
Coming up, one Democratic congressman goes to Baghdad and comes back with a call to bring back the embeds.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with some of your letters. About a month ago, we asked listeners to write in with their suggestions on how coverage of the Middle East could be improved. All the responses we received accused NPR of bias against Israel, many expressing their objections in much the same wording. Here's a sampling.
In response to our question about what is missing from the coverage, Daniel Stern wrote, You would be wise to offer historical background to the situation so that events do not exist in a temporal vacuum. The great majority of listeners have absolutely no idea what went on in the previous five decades, and certainly not before that, and yet this is utterly critical to the situation at hand.
Many objected to NPR's reluctance to use the word terrorist to describe suicide bombings. Call a spade, writes Martin A. Welt. A targeted killing of a murderer allied with terrorist groups is an act of self-defense aimed at protecting a civilian population. NPR consistently equates a homicide bombing of innocent civilians with an Israeli reprisal against terrorist targets.
Percy Dreift says NPR should name the victims of terror attacks. Quote, "This lack of names depersonalizes the tragedy. The problem is often compounded by publicizing the name of the terrorist and then interviewing his or her family as they mourn their loss and simultaneously receive congratulations for the horrific act of their relative. A powerful weapon to counter the banality of this evil is to place a name and a face on the victim."
Thanks for your letters. Keep sending them to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Since President Bush declared the end of major combat action in Iraq, the news has not been good. Saddam uncaptured, murderous bombings, power outages, political chaos, American soldiers ambushed and killed, it seems, every day. But now one Democratic congressman is very literally blaming the messenger. In an op-ed piece in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Georgia Representative Jim Marshall wondered aloud if the media, with their morbid fixation on what goes wrong, are not only missing the larger story of what goes right, but endangering American soldiers. He joins me now. Congressman, welcome to On the Media.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Was there one single thing that you saw that stands for all of the uncovered good news that somehow has been lost in the concentration on the violence against American soldiers?
As we were coming back, we had to lay over in Germany, and I was put up in a bachelor officer's quarters, and the next morning opened my door, and there was Stars and Stripes. And the headline, banner headline, maybe 3 inches, Iraqi police chief killed near Fallujah. First AD soldier dies of wounds after separate attack. And mind you, this is the military newspaper. You flip to the article, and I'm going to estimate that there are 12 column inches. The last 3/4 of an inch says this. Later Monday, delegates from the province of, can't pronounce the name, I'm sorry, where Tikrit is located, elected their first interim council, the first such election in more than 30 years. The council's main tasks will include reconstruction and resettlement of displaced Arabs and Kurds. Then I looked at this newspaper article and I went, good gosh, where are our priorities and what is this doing to our troops?
So if you were the grand managing editor of all U.S. media, what would you do differently? I'm assuming you wouldn't stop reporting about the attacks on troops and
That's right.
the notable failures of the reconstruction effort, but where would you be turning your attention?
At the height of the conventional part of this war, there were 774 embedded media with troops in Iraq. And if you took 774 reporters from across the United States and you put them in Iraq now with our troops, very few of them would be assigned to an outfit that was ambushed or that lost a soldier. Most of them would be reporting on things like the reconstruction process that's going on right now. We're actually in the process of refurbishing thousands of schools. We're getting intelligence information. There's a gradual increase in cooperation. Those kinds of stories would be the mass of the report. Now, would Americans watch it? Would they listen to it? Would they be too bored? I can't answer that question. I know that the media makes a lot of its decisions concerning what it's going to cover based upon what we are willing to stay tuned in on. And that's why in the media, they say, if it bleeds, it leads.
Much of the coverage has centered on the deaths of American soldiers and concerns itself with a major question of policy and implementation, namely whether the Pentagon grossly miscalculated the resources needed to maintain security for our personnel in that extremely hostile environment. is that not at least as pressing an issue for the media to be concerned with as whether the schools are open outside of Tikrit?
The tendency, I think, is to lump too many things together. How we got there, why we got there, was our planning adequate? But I'm not interested, nor do I think Americans should be interested, in going back and arguing now about how we got there. Let me tell you another thing about why a pall hanging over the news is not good as far as effectiveness in Iraq is concerned. That pall is something that can cause leaders in the United States to say things that, in my opinion, they don't need to be saying right now. That gets picked up by Al Jazeera. It gets shown all over Iraqi television, you know, when they've got power. What we need in Iraq is Iraqis stepping forward to secure their own freedom. They're going to be reluctant to do that if they're seeing nothing but bad news and bad comments coming from the United States. So we need to be upbeat and positive about our intention, about our objectives, and it's our positiveness that can help lead toward Iraqi involvement. More Iraqi involvement means fewer troop deaths for us.
You're making a very familiar argument because we heard it during Vietnam, the war that you fought in. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that the press muzzling itself so as not to egg on opposition leaders to criticize the administration, do you think that leads to clear thinking in the government? It certainly didn't do that during the Vietnam era.
Let's not talk about Vietnam versus Iraq right now. Look, I'd like to have more balance in the story that's being reported from Iraq. And I think that our country and our politicians are served by making their decisions within the context of a balanced picture.
You invoked the embed program, and it was a remarkable experiment, but it's also received mixed notices. Obviously, it got many journalists close to the action, and then, you know, by extension, the world of viewers and readers closer to the action. But it also got them there according to the Pentagon's overall PR agenda, allowing the government to shape the message and people's perceptions of what was going on in Iraq. In a sense, during your visit to Iraq, were you not in embed yourself, being led from success story to success story by people seeking to impress you?
I'm not a critic of the embed program in the sense that you describe. And, of course, you don't know me. I'm one of the world's biggest skeptics here. And it's true that the agenda that we had while we were in Iraq was one that involved our contact with an awful lot of military commanders and soldiers. But we set the agenda, and we effectively were able to see what we wanted to see within the constraints of security.
All right, let me ask you one more question.
Okay.
I don't know whether you're flattered or horrified by this, but House Republican leader Tom DeLay is using you as a foil to excoriate other congressional Democrats, notably several presidential candidates and Senator Ted Kennedy, for criticizing the Bush administration's handling of the war and the Reconstruction. How does it feel to be a poster child?
I really don't care who wants to carry my message. I believe the message, and I wish I could convey it to every American.
Well, Jim Marshall, thank you very much.
Sure.
Congressman Jim Marshall represents Georgia's 3rd Congressional District. He spoke to us from his office in the House.
President Bush visited the United Nations this week to try and win the General Assembly's support in the form of troops and money for the U.S. mission in Iraq. The president's message to the delegates hit on a familiar theme. If you hate terrorism, then you're with us. And if you're not with us, that must mean terrorism's okay by you.
Events during the past 2 years have set before us the clearest of divides between those who seek order and those who spread chaos.
The Week is a magazine that compiles and digests published articles from newspapers and magazines across the nation and around the world. It has two editions, one based in New York and the other in London. Both editors join me now. In New York, Bill Falk is the editor of the U.S. edition of The Week. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be here, Brooke.
And Jeremy O'Grady is editor of the British edition, and he joins us now on the phone from London. Jeremy, welcome to you, too.
Very nice to be here again.
Okay, so let's begin with some headlines, Bill. What have America's newspapers said about the Bush speech?
Well, I think there was, Brooke, a lot of puzzlement about the speech. Most of the newspapers noted that he received a rather chilly reception from the United Nations. And I think the puzzlement stems from the fact that he didn't seem to do a harder job of selling the idea of UN involvement. The New York Times, in their editorial, pointed out that he didn't grapple with the principal issues that are on the table right now, and that his address seemed more aimed at a domestic audience than a world community, given how sunny a picture he painted of a situation in which the administration is finding almost nothing as easy as it had hoped.
And that's characteristic across the country?
Yes, although the newspapers that have supported the war all along, by and large, stayed with the president on this. The Wall Street Journal, for example, their editorial was headlined "Iraq Without Apology," and they commended the president for not going to the UN and apologizing for the missing WMD or for the invasion, which they said had been justified by the atrocities that had been found in Iraq.
Okay, Jeremy, take us through the British papers.
There is, in my view, a rather dismaying tendency for all those who opposed the war to oppose the speech, and contrarywise, for all those who supported it to support the speech. You might have thought that somebody, for example, who supported the war would have said, yes, I supported the war, but he really could have done a better job at inviting the United Nations in a slightly more courteous and tempting way to get involved. We didn't get any of that. Indeed, I think what is characteristic of the British press on this is how much left and right have now split in a fairly sort of clear-cut way, with the Times and the Telegraph both very much applauding Bush's speech, the Independent and the Guardian very much deriding it, really, and the Guardian referring to Bush burnishing his self-image as the square-jawed Captain Marvel of the fight against evil.
I think it's rather interesting how the British and American presses seem to have converged since the last time we spoke. When we last spoke, we were talking about the contrast between the coverage of the weapons of mass destruction here and in Britain. And clearly, the Brits were far ahead of the U.S. press in examining the evidence and so forth. Now it seems as if there isn't as great a national divide as there is simply a partisan divide that's reflected similarly on both sides of the pond.
I think that's actually a very astute observation. Since there have been no WMDs found, and particularly since the president's popularity has plummeted, and in fact, many of the stories mentioned that the president's approval levels had plummeted to an all-time low, you begin to see the press taking a much more jaundiced view toward the administration's policies in Iraq. And even some supporters of the war, such as the Washington Post editorial page, is kind of jumping off the bandwagon, criticizing the administration for its lack of interest in truly involving the international community in the rebuilding of Iraq.
Jeremy, would you say that the American press then resembles the British press more now than it did a few months ago?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that, with this exception, possibly. Well, no, definitely. And that is that we've had so much focus this side on the Hutton inquiry, an investigation into the death of one of the people involved in judging.
Of a British government scientist who was presumably a source for the BBC in a story detailing what seemed to be sexed-up evidence for weapons of mass destruction.
Absolutely. And that's very much put the Blair administration in the firing line. The most striking thing, in a way, about the reaction to Bush's speech that I can see in the British press is that, on the whole, he's secondary to people's obsessions over here at the moment. It's Blair that they want to attack or defend much more. What people really wanted to know over here seem to be whatever Bush's reasons for prosecuting this war, why did Blair have to join him?
I'm very curious about what the coverage was, or if there was any mention of the peculiar shape that the president's speech took. He spent about a third of it on Iraq, then veered off slightly into nuclear proliferation, and then served up a heaping helping of outrage over the world sex trade, which, of course, is a horrendous issue that the world needs to address, but seemed a bit off topic here. Did anybody make anything of that?
A number of the stories noted that he brought it up, but the take on it seems to be that this is an issue that is important to the Christian right, and that people had approached Bush about it and asked him to take up this cause. The other analysis is that this was something positive that all the world's nations could agree on, and that the president wanted to end up in that way rather than on the more contentious issue of Iraq.
Quite a lot of commentary over here, too, especially the more critical sort, is that this was actually an address to a domestic audience. And that certainly might explain some of the pitch of Bush's speech, which was both why it was so much less conciliatory than it otherwise might have been, and why it included blatantly irrelevant references to the sex trade and other important, but at the time being, not germane issues.
Let me conclude then with a question that really veers off the topic, perhaps in the spirit of the president's speech, that of magician David Blaine, who performs feats of physical skill or stamina in the city of New York frequently and is now in London. Jeremy, would you describe what he's doing there and what the reaction has been?
Yes. What he's doing there is suspending himself in a glass cage, I think it's for 44 days, something like that, with only a water drip to keep his body in order. I think David Blaine is beginning to learn something he probably would have preferred not to, about the nature of the British temperament, which is a delight in seeing anyone who puts his head above the parapet getting it knocked off. And so what happens is that people have thrown eggs at him. Somebody, I think it was a British tabloid newspaper, actually launched a remote-controlled helicopter with a Big Mac attached to it and hovered it by the glass cage so that the poor starving man could only look with frustration at this dripping meat burger.
Do you think that Blaine's showmanship has been conflated with American overreaching?
I think that's a very acute observation, although we haven't really picked up on it over here.
We did actually look at the British press coverage of Blaine here in the U.S. week, and I definitely did sense a subtext that this was an audacious American who was getting his comeuppance.
Had he been French, he might have got a better reaction. Actually, on second thoughts, cancel that. Had he been Italian, he'd have been all right.
Jeremy O'Grady, thank you very much.
Okay, very nice to be on.
Jeremy O'Grady edits The Week in the U.K. And Bill, thanks to you too.
Thanks, it was fun, Brooke.
Bill Falk edits The Week in the U.S.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Katya Rogers, Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Jennifer Munson. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I have a perfect part for you in Terminator 4.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Finish. You know, this is completely impolite. This is the way you treat women. We know that.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.